Welcome back to Radio Rothbard. I'm Ryan McMakin, executive editor at the Mises Institute. And we're going to talk today about pronatalism. I don't know, you may or may not out there have come across this, but if you have, you've probably come across it in the context of perhaps Elon Musk, who likes to talk about it a lot. But there's a certain tiny subset of people out there who are constantly talking about the need to have as many children as possible, that everybody should just have as many children as possible, and are constantly throwing out this idea that if the population decreases much, that this is going to lead to the end of civilization. So they put forward a lot of arguments about it, some of which are fine, and some of which are just completely false and terrible. And we're going to talk about the economic arguments that they put out there, and how most of the economic arguments being used in defense of pronatalism are just not good. And so let's examine that in some detail. And to do that today, I have on Ryan Turnipseed. Ryan is a graduate student in entrepreneurship at Oklahoma State University, and he's also a summer fellow at the Mises Institute this summer. And our summer fellow program is where we bring in graduate students, sometimes some younger faculty members, and provide them a place to do academic research, maybe toward a book, maybe toward their PhD, that sort of thing. So he's part of that program this summer, and he's got an article that I liked from this week. It's called "The Purpose of Production and the Economy: A Criticism of Pronatalist Economics." So I want to talk about that a little bit. Ryan, welcome. First, I want you to just tell us what pronatalism is, and maybe it has some famous proponents that people might have heard of, and just kind of make sure that people have some general sense of what it is we're talking about here.
Right, right. Well, thank you very much for having me on. It's always nice to turn a gathering into a convocation of Ryan's. Quite fond of the name. But yes, as for pronatalism, it's a very recent phenomenon. Like, it's been around for a long time, especially in more niche right-wing spheres traditionally. But especially after, say, 2020, it started to grow and expand more ideologically to where now in the modern day you have the likes of Elon Musk and J.D. Vance especially, I think, are the most popular proponents of the idea. And as for what pronatalism is, it is this this idea or this prescription that people need to have more children for one reason or another. We'll get into the reasons, I'm sure, but it's this imperative that people are not having enough children, they should have more children, and if they don't have more children, something bad will happen.
And so let's go ahead and just get into some of the arguments then. And I just want to note that, right, there are economic and there are non-economic arguments here, right? Now,
yes.
And a lot of the non-economic arguments I don't have a problem with, right? And I think this is what attracts conservatives to the whole thing, is they look at it, and a lot of the times they're religious, and they say, look, families are good, right? And I've written many articles saying families are great. They're in fact the most important non-state institution, and the world would be a better place if we had lots of large families that people spend a lot of time with, and that often one of the biggest illnesses of our age is that a lot of people's longest lasting and most meaningful relationship is with the state, right? They spend less and less time, the sociological data is on this, people spend less and less time with other family members. And over time, they become these atomized individuals, and what they look forward to most is their check from the government every month, right? Rather than, right, investing yourself in this institution that is your family. And that is weakening substantially. So conservatives look at that and they think that's bad, and I agree with them.
Right, yeah. We have this thing which forms the cornerstone of any natural society, how people would normally organize. And then we have the state that, you know, views it as a threat. This is a very old line of argument, and decides to break up families, support policies that dissolve families and whatnot else, because ultimately a atomized society, the result of a society with a large state, is one that's easier to control, farm for taxes, all the usual stuff. So this is a my criticism hopefully is not taken as I am against families, large families, having children and whatnot else. I just find the pronatalist movement in particular to be a very poor representation of what I find to be a noble goal, which is families are good, people should have children. These are all ethical or moral arguments. They're not economic. It's just the movement, the pronatalist movement is lacking.
Right. It's as a movement, of course, it's not, and it's certainly not all religious people. Right.
Correct.
You get people like Elon Musk. You get a lot of these like weird, they're always weird, these Silicon Valley people who are into like post-humanism and everything. And if you do Google pronatalism, you get like a million articles about some creepy couple. Like,
yes, the Collinses.
Okay. Yes. And they're wearing like, why are they always wearing like weird hyper faddish glasses? Have you noticed this?
Yes. I'm struggling to remember the first names. I know one is Simone. But they're like this weird neo-Puritan couple. Like they have this like aesthetic that looks like it could have been from Puritan New England. And then they have these strange glasses. Like the general consensus of anyone that's not inside the pronatal movement is that they're weird, off-putting, sort of uncanny, you know, which once again, that's just the consensus. It's not necessarily passing judgment here, though I really want to. But it's not the greatest figurehead, once again, for a movement that is claiming to be the proponents of the thing that I like, and then they mangle it with their arguments. But yeah, it's a really weird group of people. Very eclectic. There's a lot of, if I remember correctly, this couple that we're talking about organizes the pronatal conference. It's had people that I'm good friends with. It's also had, this guy that I attack in my article, Lyman Stone. It's had Brian Kaplan there. It's a very eclectic ideological mix. But they all agree people should have more children. Yeah, so we'll get into that more, I'm sure, but it's a very weird mix of people.
Well, just to give you a sense of some of the other arguments, right? There's lots of people arguing things like a man should have lots of children, right? This disciplines you. It makes you a better person. It keeps you from frittering your life away on navel gazing and just consuming frivolities and all this stuff. And I actually tend to agree with that stuff. Two.
Right. Yes.
And I have four children, been married for almost 26 years now. I like that stuff. I like having kids around. I like raising kids. It's definitely made me a better person, so on and so forth. However, there are also a lot of just very dumb arguments in favor of pronatalism. And I think that's what we're going to talk about. And just as one last note also, I haven't asked you about this, but I do not subscribe to the idea that the population of the earth is much too high. And the reason I don't like these pronatalist arguments is because I wish the human population would be reduced by 50% or something like that, right? That's not part of my ideology. I don't have an ideological reason for wanting people to have fewer children. So that's not part of what we're going to be discussing here either.
And in fact, I think that the first times that I have appeared on any sort of online media, I was arguing against the sort of Club of Rome position that we need to like socially engineer people to have less children, promote contraception, all this other stuff, which like I, due to my religious beliefs, find to be immoral, an abrogation of a command from God and all this other stuff, not that other people need to accept it with the economic arguments. But I've spoken against these things quite extremely. It's just that, once again, the pronatal movement is now more front and center than these population reductionists. They're more new. And the kind of like the conservative movement in the history of the American right sort of took over what it meant to be right wing. I'm afraid that these pronatalists that we are talking about are going to take over this position and define what it means to be in favor of having children. This is not a desirable outcome that I want to see. I hope to fight against it and win is the big concern.
That's a good point, too. We should actually establish ourselves now as the sane pronatalists, right? Quote, unquote, right? Because we're in favor of people having children. We're also not nutty, post-humanist, crazy sort of... like Elon, have 10 kids via IVF and spend no time with any of them. I mean, just all of the stuff that they do. No, we're actually in favor of normal, like natural families, which, by the way, predates the state, right? As you kind of hinted to a few minutes ago, this is a fundamental issue in a lot of stuff I've written on, is the foundation, the family is foundational to human civilization. It's natural in like the most biological and sociological sense, whereas the state is a made-up institution that only exists in certain times and places. Families exist always and everywhere in human civilization. That's something totally different. So we're in favor of that. Also, families created the old-fashioned way. You know, it's interesting that we're going to brush up a little bit in this discussion against like Marxists' critiques of things. But in his book that I recently edited, Ralph Rako talks about how the Marxists had big plans for the family, right? They always had... Right. Nobody who's a control freak can ever stay away from telling people what to do with their families, it seems. Right. And we're getting this from now pronatalists. And of course, we got it from the Marxists, too. And Ralph, in his book, this is called The Struggle for Liberty, by the way, came out this year from the Mises Institute. I recommend you check it out. And so in this book, which is kind of a history of political thought, right, he quotes Trotsky talking about how, like, we're going to engineer the family to be more productive, to be more brilliant, to be more amazing, and talks about how we're not going to allow people to just marry whoever they want anymore. And Ralph notes that, you know, for millennia, human beings were allowed to just kind of pair off and do things the old-fashioned way, what Ralph calls, quote, that whole boy-girl thing, unquote. And the Marxists hate that. They hate that people just kind of do that naturally, and that just what naturally happens kind of flows from that. Instead, it's all going to be about planning. It's all going to be about some agenda. It's all going to be about maximizing economic output or something like this. And so let's get into that then, right? So we've covered all these non-economic arguments, some of which are pretty good. So what are the economic arguments being made here that you note in this article, and then we can get into what the problems are with them?
Right. And it might be worth mentioning before we fully transition over to the economic arguments, some of the appeals are disguised in terms of like national security and all these other things which have economic elements to them. Quite frankly, I find specifically the national security argument, if America does not have enough children, then it's going to be taken over in the future. Like, I find this one to be the weakest argument just because, believe it or not, America is not the only country in the world suffering from this total fertility rate decline. The majority of the provinces in, say, India, this very highly populated country, are below 2.0. So this is Russia, China as well are suffering from either natural or self-imposed population issues. So,
well, that's a big just. And you think you're right. We should absolutely establish that, right? Because I don't want the comment section filled with the usual like pro-war garbage about how China's going to take over. Right? China has a major population problem.
Self-imposed,
100%. Because yet again, the Marxists couldn't keep their hands off family planning, so they imposed this one-child rule for a long time. They change people thinking, they get rid of it, and population growth still has not recovered. So it's a country of very old people, very low population growth, and a lot of people are saying even that their population estimates are way overblown, that actually
right.
China doesn't even have as many people as they claim. So that's a whole thing on its own. So yeah, so spare me the comments about how China's going to all move to North America. Unless Americans have 10 IVF kids each. So let's go to the economic arguments then. Give us the rundown on what they're saying there.
So there's a few economic arguments. They focus on slightly different specific statistics, but most of them are the same. If we don't have like a constantly increasing population, something bad in the economic statistics is going to start falling, and we're all going to plunge into chaos, depression. Everyone's going to lose their like life savings and whatever else. So there's this one woman whose name I do not remember right now, who was interviewed for one of the big newspapers, if I recall correctly, who was saying that like if we have a sudden population decline, aggregate demand is going to fall, and we'll be plunged into a depression. This very strange Keynesian argument based off of population growth instead of the usual Keynesian points. Mr. Lyman Stone, who I attack in my article, he has a number of economic statistics-backed points that he makes. So it's no esoteric knowledge that the American economy is very strongly centralized around the housing market. A lot of people believe that their house will just perpetually increase in price, and that's their savings. They can sell it at a future date after it's just inexplicably risen by like 400% in monetary value. They'll be fine. They can consume all that in retirement and whatever else. Lyman Stone is here to warn those people that if the population doesn't keep growing, demand for housing is going to fall and the prices are going to start going down. This is horrendous, apparently, to Lyman Stone. Which is strange because as
clearly
we'll
he's a man who's already bought a house and is currently a homeowner. So he only benefits if number go up, I guess.
Yeah, right, right. But this is also strange because as we'll get into as we dig deeper, like one of the arguments for why aren't people having as many children that the pronatalists make is that housing is too expensive. So like they also argue for other government interventions and policies to try to make housing cheaper while saying that the reason you should care about the declining population is because the housing prices will fall. It's a very contradictory, paradoxical argument. There are some people who say that, so let's say we've covered consumption, housing prices. There are others that sort of like sneak in a moral claim into how the economy works. They say that people are like falling into this like consumptive behavior. They're becoming consumerists. When they should be having more children, producing more, they should be stop dedicating time to themselves towards consumption, towards all this other stuff, and they should be producing. So it's a sort of garbed in economics, but in reality, there's a moral claim under there. You should instead of this is how it is. So I think those are the three big ones that you're most likely to hear. And overall, it's always going to be some variant of, if you don't have more children, if the whole country does not have more children, an economic statistic will go down. That's bad. We'll be thrown into a depression. You'll be worse off materially, which is, once again, a strange appeal to make for people that supposedly have these very pressing moral views about pronatalism. You would think they wouldn't have to resort to these very materialistic appeals about economic statistics. You think they could just stick to the moral claims and that would be convincing enough, but they don't. They venture into something they don't know about. A very famous Rothbard quote is that if people were wrong about economics, it would be fine, but unfortunately many people who are wrong speak about economics, so we have to deal with it.
And they have very strong opinions about it.
Yes.
So, all right, well, let's talk about that, this whole like consumerism thing. Right. Oh, we need housing prices to go up. You need to have more babies so that people buy more stuff. And this touches on a very important issue. Right. You will encounter this a lot when you're just involved in economic theory and writing about it publicly and stuff, because there is this impression among many people that economics, the idea that free markets are good, is premised on this idea that therefore, that wanting free market economics is the same thing as wanting like to maximize GDP at all times. And right. I've been seeing more and more of this on social media. A lot of it's kind of dumb. A lot of it's claiming that in order to maximize GDP, you need to give up everything decent in life. I don't think that's really true, but that's certainly like a conservative thing that's out there, is that don't spend time with your family, spend it maximizing GDP, and then you'll be better off. Like this, however, and this is, I'm getting this from these pronatalists too. This is premised on this idea that we're making like this moral argument that if you want a free economy, therefore what that translates into is constantly worrying about maximizing efficiency, work, productivity, etc. But that's simply not the case at all, especially for those of us who are involved with, say, Austrian school theory. There's nothing in the theory that says there's a certain direction the economy must take. Good free economy will maximize home prices. A good free economy will deliver more consumer goods in more variety. That's not what we're saying, and there is no normative nature of that in our economic theory. In fact, this idea that you're supposed to maximize productivity at all time has no place in economic theory. And there's a fun section in that in Rothbard's History of Economic Thought, where he talks a little about, I think it's James Mill, And he talks a little bit how it affected John Stuart Mill. But there's a certain obsession in the Anglosphere and economics of you need to be productive at all time. You need work is like by its very nature good, and leisure by its nature is bad. And Rothbard looks at this and he sees it for what it is just some sort of external moral viewpoint being inserted into economic theory, that work is superior, is metaphysically superior to leisure. And
right.
That's not an aspect of economic theory. And he traces it back to some sort of like disordered hyper-Calvinism on the part of James Mill that he talks about a little bit. And he says there are plenty of other great economists, and he mostly points to like, say, 16th century Dominicans and things like that, that the purpose of work is leisure. And the purpose of work isn't work. I mean, this is a bizarre conclusion that some people have come to. You should work as much as possible. Why? To maximize economic growth. Okay, well, how does that benefit me if I'm not getting any more leisure? The purpose of your life is to like get some time off. And So I'm sick of people assigning to us like this sociological view of, well, you're for free market economics, so therefore you want me to work 80 hours a week so that I can buy more cars or I can buy a larger house. Don't care. The market doesn't care what sort of house you want or car you drive. In fact, the market will deliver what you actually want with sans government intervention. And if we had all the time in the world, you get into the many ways that the government intervention actually encourages overpriced garbage. Through financialization and stuff, right? But
right.
If you prefer leisure to maximizing your personal GDP, you could drive a $20,000 car. This is not a problem from a free market standpoint. You could move into a 3-bedroom, 1-bath house much, much cheaper. And there's no problem with that. The market will deliver that if that's what everybody wants. And that's not something that the market requires. The market does not require consumerism. And that's a point I make in an earlier article, is that it's actually the government that's constantly telling you to consume more, right? I remember back during the 2008 crash, Dick Cheney was constantly talking about how you need to spend more money, spend your last dime or the terrorists win. And these conservatives were all whining about the paradox of thrift and that you shouldn't save money, you should spend money. That'll make the economy better. And so what they're constantly telling you, these people who claim to be free market, is that you get rid of your savings, just buy a bunch of trinkets, and that's what will make the economy better. That is not good economics, folks, and that's not free market economics. That's just some garbage invented by like modern Keynesian thinking, which many conservatives subscribe to and which we're seeing here in this sort of thing. And you make a lot of these similar points too, right? Is that making prices go up, what does that have to do with like good market economics? There's just no clear connection there. But these people seem to have confused that somehow. And they seem to think that buying more stuff and making prices rise has something to do with building a stronger economy. It's very odd. And where do you think they're getting it?
Well, so I think it's fundamentally just that they don't understand the economy at its most basic level. And I mean that literally. Because for the Austrian School of Economics, the first chapter of Human Action, Man, Economy, and State, the two major books that sort of explain, at the very least, the Misesian system of economics, which is, I would say, the most developed and consistent, the first chapter of both start with, humans have means and ends. An end is a want. I want something. I have a future desired state of affairs. And means are the things that I use to get there. And then you can call means goods, ends wants, however you want to phrase it. This is just this fundamental idea at the start of all economic thinking. And this is when you start saying the purpose of humanity, production, the economy, and all this other stuff is to maximize statistics, you're departing from this idea that people fundamentally just have wants that they want to satisfy. They have a future state of affairs they want, and you produce means, try to acquire them, you save in order to satisfy those wants. So you brought up a lot of really good points here just now. So Rothbard actually does talk about this idea of growth. In fact, I think it's in his magnum opus, Man, Economy, and State, where he says that growth is as foreign concept from the field of biology that's been imported as a metaphor into economics. Like the, when you talk about economic growth, you're talking about something that's it's like natural, inevitable, and necessary. That like that's the connotation in biology. And a lot of people, I think, just hear the word GDP growth. They think it's good and inevitable. It must happen. You know, plants and animals, cells and whatever else grow, and they need to survive. And it's inevitable. This is just the natural biological function of growth. This is not economic thinking. This is a ill-placed metaphor. And beyond that, I remember reading through a lot of old conservative work from like the 50s and the 40s when they were trying to really go back to the classics. And they came across this idea that modeled especially what a lot of the Quakers in the colonial United States thought, which is like leisure is not only something that we consume, say, as a good in any economic parlance. It's not something that it's not just something that I go after. But if you want to attach a moral analysis to it, leisure is actually necessary to get a lot of the things that we want. All of the great scientists that produced things that have greatly improved the human condition, they had leisure time to think about these things, to sort of play around with ideas and all this other stuff. If they were just working, say, at a desk or whatever else for their entire life, they wouldn't have produced these things. A lot of our great philosophers, the people that have, say, led to the Industrial Revolution, this philosophical idea, as Rothbard talks about a lot, they had leisure time in order to think these things through. So this is me being normative here. This isn't descriptive purely, but I think it would be pretty hard to argue that leisure itself does not lead to a great social benefit in terms of welfare. I can't descriptively prove that, but it would be hard to argue that if people didn't have time to sit around, think, come up with ideas, play around with the ideas, that we'd be much poorer. So those are two main points, which means going back to the thing I said about means and ends, leisure is an end. People want to enjoy things, shall we say. They produce things so that they can eat, have more time to sleep, spend with their family, do things they just want to do, things they're intrinsically motivated to do due to their own preferences and tastes. And the economy exists, production exists, savings exist in order to allow that to happen at a higher rate, at higher quality, and all these other things. And you have these people called entrepreneurs that tried to deliver more and better things that allow people to get what they want. This is a kind of a tragedy of basing economics around statistics in the last century. It's really not that complicated. You don't need to do all these measurements, have all these fancy statistical methods in order to communicate this very basic fact of human economics, which is the economy is not the end. The economy, when we talk about economic phenomenon, we're usually talking about the means that people use to get to their ends. In fact, when we discuss ends, as a lot of these people do, people should do this or that to benefit the economy, they've left the economic science entirely. They're talking about ethics and morality. So this is the whole modern idea of economics is fundamentally confused. They've inverted everything about it, which, and I mentioned this at the start of the article that recently went out. This is why I like the Austrian school. It starts very grounded, makes these very basic statements that are impossible to refute. People have ends, and they use means to achieve them, and it builds everything off from there. Modern economics, you start by learning Cartesian coordinate plane graphs and all this other stuff, and you have to use the graphs to sort of extrapolate that to real behavior, and it breaks down at some point.
Yeah, it's all very statistics-based. There's very little sound theory, and I guess that's why they so easily get tricked into capitulating to Marxist critiques. And you see that a lot in Lyman Stone's talk here, right? The idea is, if we're going to have a good economy, we need more people producing more stuff, and then you get growth. And that is how an economy is improved. And the Marxists have long been saying, and this is part of their consumerist critique, is that what free market economics is based on is, as you say, on growth, right, which is itself a bad analogy. But the examples they give are, they hate advertising, right? This is a long Marxist tradition of critiquing advertising. Yes. What is the purpose of advertising? The purpose of advertising is to trick people into consuming more, because consuming baubles and stuff is the only way to grow the economy. So capitalists are constantly trying to convince people to just to buy more stuff. And that is it. They never talk about saving, right? You could have a very strong, wonderful economy based on saving and investment. Interest rates would go down. People could retire sooner. They would be more solid. They would have a safety net. All of this stuff. No. And that's a purely wonderful capitalist way of going about it. We think an economy would be better. There's kind of like for a variety of reasons, if based on saving and investment rather than on just buying a bunch of stuff. But what the Marxists will tell you is that no, capitalism is premised on buying a bunch of stuff. And so you need more people. You need more people buying things constantly and nobody holding back. You have to constantly maximize your engagement with the consumer market. And they also said that this explained Western imperialism, because the only way markets could grow was for Western imperialists, that is capitalists in their mind, to go to other countries, force open their markets, and then force the natives there, whether in China, Japan, sub-Saharan Africa, or whatever, hey, all you people, you have to start focusing your life around buying stuff that we're manufacturing in the home country. And so they said that capitalism required imperialism because it requires the forcible opening of markets and bringing people into the market and forcing them to buy stuff and destroying their old way of life. That's pure gibberish from the point of view of someone who understands the real purpose of markets. A real free market would, a merchant would show up in, say, Cape Town in 1750, say, hey, do any of you people here want to buy anything? And they probably would want to buy stuff, and they would keep showing up and providing those goods and services. Maybe even the locals would use those goods and services to become more productive at home. And then they would have an ability, they would start making things that the merchants wanted to buy. And then there would be a two-way trade, right? Where both were exchanging manufactured goods in different places. However, and nowhere active in that would be the state. The state doesn't need to come in and rearrange people's lives, tell them what to buy, encourage them to buy stuff from the home country. This is just people doing what they do and buying stuff. And there's no imperialism involved. So we just simply don't need what the Marxists claim we need, which is constant increase in inputs and constant increase in new consumers. But that's essentially what Lyman is arguing here, is the reason we need more population growth is so we have more consumers, and more consumers makes a growing economy. And that's not good economics at all.
Right, exactly. And there's two major points on that I'd like to touch on. The first one is like the role of consumption in a free market economy without the government. If the government was not present, if you did not have state intervention, rather, would be a better way to phrase that, people would save a lot more. They'd be a lot more future-oriented, because what entity is it in the current economy that makes saving unviable as a means of future consumption? It's the state. The state keeps interest rates artificially low. They discourage savings. They try to stimulate consumption at every depression that they cause. They encourage people to live for the here and now. This is the famous Keynesian argument: you're all dead in the long run. So this is a major government intervention. This sort of presentism that's been inculcated in society, and of course, businesses being very friendly with government go along with it. They get paid by the government. They get government positions and whatever else. They fall into line behind all of this. The government is the one that regulates businesses and forces them to hyper-standardize everything that they make. It sort of drives out what would be sort of local artisanal production, because it's no longer viable. They can't keep up with all the regulations, the cost of production that's been increased by the government. And so they can't make their unique things. The only people that can produce and sell on the market are these larger corporations that are in the sort of government sphere. So this is the first thing. All of these arguments that Marxist pronatalists and whoever else makes about people being selfish and consumerist and whatever else, people being selfish and consumerist is a government policy. This is not the natural state of things. This is something that gets lost, which is why when you see pronatalists like Lyman Stone, I mentioned in my article, making this criticism of consumerism, if I remember correctly, he even says people spend too much leisure time on themselves, as if leisure is this purchasable good. They need to stop showering as much and sleeping as much. They need to drink coffee and do more work and have more children. This is an ill-placed response to, to a problem caused by the government. This is, if you look around outside and you see people that are sort of burning out from having to work, like especially this this idealized idea of a job from the 80s or 90s, these large corporations that'll fire the bottom 10% in their company the least productive. This is not natural market organization. A lot of these companies were consolidated by the government. A lot of them were broken up by the government due to antitrust. It's a very interventionist economy that we have that encourages these things so that these companies can stay over the hurdles imposed by the government. It's a sort of a crazy barnyard catastrophe of an economy.
Well, I wanted to just interject something in there about one important part of government intervention that needs to be brought up is the matter of the welfare state. So these pronatalists, they throw around all of these predictions about how human civilization will end if population goes down based on nothing that I've seen. They just kind of say that. I can point to many scenarios in which population goes down and people can still become more productive. It's not like capital disappears. In fact, I have an article where I wrote, I looked at the history of that. And the article's called "The Fertility Crisis is a Government-Caused Crisis." One point I make is that we actually can see a few cases in history where population went down and actually standard of living went up. Because just because population disappears doesn't mean capital disappears. It actually means more land available for the workers. You can see this after the Black Death. First one or two generations after the Black Death, after the population had decreased by 50% in some places. This has been described by many historians as a golden age for working class people. Because suddenly their labor was extremely in demand. There was too much land, too few people, and it massively changed the face of Western politics, arguably in a good way. And so people's standard of living then went up afterward. Yep, overall GDP went down, clearly, because there were fewer people. GDP per capita arguably increased substantially as a result. So isn't that what we want? We want GDP per capita to go up. We want productivity per capita to go up, and productivity can go up in place of a declining population, especially once we've already become a technological civilization. We are not some old agrarian thing where we need gang labor. This was the mistake that the old South always made, is they thought they could be more productive by going all in on gang labor while the North was industrializing and becoming far more productive far more quickly. Yeah, those days are gone. We already have technology and we can use that. It's amazing that people still make this argument and when we're all talking about AI and everything. People are getting laid off left and right as they're being replaced by AI, and we're still arguing, we need more people to keep up our current level of productivity. They never offer any convincing data on this from what I've seen. But the one thing that needs to be mentioned is part of the reason, and always be suspicious when you get someone from the government talking about you need more immigration, you need more population growth, because we need to sustain the economy. What they're really saying is, no, we need more younger people to come in and pay into the welfare state. That's what they're really arguing. The future of the welfare state depends in many cases on large population growth, because thanks to a few generations of the welfare state and encouraging people to retire while they're still perfectly able to work for years and years. You got people retiring for 25, 30 years while they're still perfectly fine. And then they all whine all day about how current workers aren't paying enough taxes and Social Security and everything. They're buying RVs. They're doing exactly what these population growth people want. They're frittering away all of their savings on jet skis and stuff. And then they retire and spend 20 years living off the dole of current day workers. That all depends on population growth. That all depends on getting a bunch of younger workers in to slave away to keep the welfare state going. But of course, that has nothing to do with expanding the economy in any sort of real free market way. So we just need to acknowledge that issue, that what a lot of these people, especially that quote-unquote former, I like how you put scare quotes around former CIA agent, right? Never take anything some guy who was in the CIA says at face value. It's probably some amoral nihilist writing this column for who knows what reason, but he's a pro-natalist. You can link to it, and he links to it in the article, folks. But he's saying, yeah, we need more people. I suspect he's just got his marching orders from the regime, which is we need more people to pay into the welfare state, because that's what I usually see coming out of these people. So, yeah, again, nothing to do with the free markets. A lot of it has to do with just keeping the welfare state going. So, no thanks. I'm not going to support population growth for that reason.
Right. And then whenever this welfare state, which is based off of a growing population, this very infeasible idea of a perpetually growing population, whenever it starts to falter because population declines, the problem isn't that the welfare state is aberrant, ill-organized, or anything else. The problem is that you aren't having enough children. It's your fault that the welfare state is collapsing due to its absolutely terrible organization and terrible reason for being in the first place. So typically, in a free economy, people would be producing, entrepreneurs would be trying to predict what consumers will want in the future and trying to satisfy those wants. It's a very humanitarian system, contrary to a lot of the anti-market propaganda that gets passed around. People are producing to serve each other so that they can, in turn, live better in the future. And something you'd expect, as things get better, people produce more things so that they can consume more, you know, be better off, enjoy the things they want to enjoy, you'd expect prices to fall. And the reason for that is because things get more abundant as people save, things become more productive, labor becomes more productive as a result of the technology that we have. This is what you'd expect. Prices fall, people can have more things that they enjoy, things that make their lives better, you know, prolong their lives, you know, shield them from the hostile world outside. This is what we would consider like an increase in welfare or economic growth, is that people are satisfying more of their ends. And you'd expect this to be reflected by falling prices. And one example of this is that food is extremely cheap now compared to how it was 400 years ago. I have to spend a lot less of my money trying to feed myself. And as a result, I can do more things. I can save more. I can invest more. That's because the prices of food are lower because we produce a lot more of it than we ever have in history. As soon as we get to the housing market, because we've had so much bad economics, government propaganda, and whatever else surrounding that specific industry, when you tell people that the actual, like, natural tendency for prices is that they're supposed to fall, this deflation is the scare word that gets passed around, and you start applying it to the housing industry, everyone loses their minds. And that's just because we have government interventions which have told people that the prices of housing will continue to rise forever. Sort of like the welfare state. We'll just have more population forever and you'll be taken care of later in life. So too will your house price rise and your future will be assured because you can just sell your house for way more than you bought it for just because you sat on it, didn't destroy it or consume the house, shall we say. And you'll be taken care of. But on a free market, we have no reason to expect that housing would be a perpetually increasing cost. Like, we have no reason to expect that the price of housing will just rise in perpetuity until only a few people in the population can afford to buy a house. Instead, what we would expect is that prices would fall. People would find better ways to build housing. People would find different places to put housing and all this other stuff. This very basic innovation through the market sort of idea. Instead, what we get in the hampered market is we have currency manipulation. We have government regulations, zoning laws, immigration policies that subsidize immigration, all of which drive up the price of housing in perpetuity. This isn't what you'd expect. This is not the sign of a growing economy. This is the sign of something that's necessary. Shelter is necessary, quite famously. You have, you know, food, water, fire, shelter. This is a catastrophic indicator of welfare. People can't afford shelter. If you talked about any, say, third world country, and you said the price of housing has been going up for the last 70 years and no one can afford a house anymore, you know, the average person would say, wow, that's terrible, those poor people. But if you say it's in the American context, people will start freaking out because their investment in their house isn't going to secure them like 30 years of retirement consumption or some other aberrant behavior. So I would make the argument personally, this is probably what is resulting in fewer children being born. Like, my generation cannot afford houses in the same way that people could in the 20s, 30s, 40s, and 50s. They have to spend a lot more of their income on housing than most other generations. if they can even get it in the first place. And that means that they don't have as much children. They don't have the space for it. They're trying to grapple with this problem that few other people have faced, or at least in the last few generations, and they aren't having children. But I find it, so that's why I find it very strange that a prominent pronatalist like Lyman Stone says the reason that people need to have more children is to drive the price of housing up. It's a self-defeating argument. It's aberrant. It's not what we'd expect on the free market. And this isn't a sign of human development increasing. It's a sign of things getting worse.
Well, that takes us into you kind of already answered my final question, which was going to be, right, what does a world look like where we're not meddling and trying to make population growth go up, and maybe population in some periods it's stable, in some periods it goes down for a while. Also, let's try and just look beyond like 5 years from now, right? In the longer term, if population goes down, there's no reason to think that it wouldn't ever go back up again.
Right.
I mean, well, I don't know why people come to that conclusion, that it's just going to go down forever until nobody's having children. First of all, you talk to religious people, they like having children, and they will even take a hit to their standard of living to have more children. They'll drive old cars, they'll take fewer vacations. They haven't been totally indoctrinated into this idea that you need to just buy stuff constantly. They don't care what influencers are telling them. They haven't ruined their lives because they saw some fashionable commercial or something like that. They're like, you know what? I'm going to wear old clothes. I'm going to have like 5 or 6 kids. I'm going to have a lower standard of living. And some people make that choice. And what I think is really funny is that it's those sorts of religious people, those sorts of anti-establishment people, who are creating most of the population growth in this country. I find it delightful, yes, that hard left people who say, oh, I can't have any children because of global warming. Great. Don't have children. Love it. Good idea. Please remove yourself from the gene pool. Meanwhile, these traditionalist Catholics with 7, 8 kids, they will replace you, friend. That's fine by me. And so these people, they make a choice. But what, of course, so they're constantly being told by the government and by people who have this bizarre consumerist idea of the economy is that, no, you need to just constantly buy more stuff, more luxury stuff, and that's the sign of a better economy. But say we did have a society where there were just genuinely fewer people, right? You kind of hinted at that, right? Oh, no, the price of, there might be a lot of homes and not as many people bidding up the prices of them. Okay. I mean, kind of, you note that Lyman's point was that, oh, gee, the price of your home will go down and then your net worth will go down. Okay, well, that's hardly the end of the world. First of all, don't invest your entire net worth into home prices. Also, if you're in a situation where there's a stable or declining population and you don't have people bidding up prices for things like homes, they're probably also not bidding up prices for things like automobiles, for things like auto insurance, for things like higher education, for things like healthcare. And the prices of all those things are going down. So does it even matter that my net worth has declined by 10% if prices of everything declined by 10%? So the whole idea is that we need to maximize prices to maximize net worth is crazy. Because right, if prices go down, your net worth doesn't have to go up by nearly as much, if at all. And so I just don't know where people get this idea.
Well, and this is a point that I sort of tried to make in the beginning and end of my article, is that because of these fallacies and this misunderstanding of the economy by the mainstream, there's this idea that the economy or the market is this creature that does things, like it's an entity that provides for people or whatnot else. When in reality, it's composed of people, and those people are the ones that actually they do actions, is the sort of a Austrian way of talking about it. They think about, they rank their ends, they act accordingly. You have entrepreneurs in the market who try to provide for people. They're the ones that pay wages to workers. They're the ones that try to speculate as to what people will want in the future. So I actually think you answered this the best when you brought up the Black Death. So let's talk about a very sudden and tragic loss of life, such that the population is devastated, in terms of numbers at least. What will happen? Well, labor is more scarce. If I'm an entrepreneur and I want to produce things, I have to pay more, bidding against other entrepreneurs to get people to work for me, so the wages will have to increase. And then similarly, land, there's not as many people on the land anymore. People that have a lot of land will keep trying to lower the price, trying to get people to purchase it because they can't take care of it anymore. The price of labor is high. You know, I can't have as many farmhands, groundskeepers, or whoever else. I have to sell it off. The price of land falls. This is all a very basic adjustment that happens by real people on the market in response to populations declining. Similarly, entrepreneurs produce things, as I said, for consumers in the future. They try to speculate what they want. They'll take into account that there's going to be less people buying. This means there's not going to be as high of a price. Not as many people are buying. They're going to produce slightly less. You know, the demand will decrease. The supply will eventually decrease as well as entrepreneurs try to adjust to these things. There will be error because people don't just perfectly see the future. They don't know perfectly what people want. But nevertheless, it adapts to what people actually want, which is a stark difference from the Marxists, Keynesians, pronatalists, and whoever else that tell people what they want and try to conform the economy to it. Entrepreneurs on the market try to conform their actions and their production to what they think people want just intrinsically, according to their own tastes and desires. So this is what happens. People in the market adjust to the population just normally. Entrepreneurs aren't stupid. They look at what they're getting into when they try to invest a ton of time and money and stress and effort into these businesses. They speculate what the market's going to look like. They may be wrong, but they would certainly take into account that if it's so long term they have to care about the population, they'll want to know whether it's increasing or decreasing. We aren't helpless is sort of the thing that I'm trying to get at here. It's not like everyone just is like a robot that just keeps doing something repeatedly, and if some part of the market changes, then everyone's going to keep going and destroy something. People adapt. People see things. Even if you have the most dismal view of the average person, you take like an H.L. Mencken view of what the average person is like, even they still economically act. They understand these things.
Yes, there are actually intelligent people that could help us cope with a stable or decreasing population. And yeah, that's just a great point you make there, right? Is the economy is not like some machine that we're just at the mercy of, right? The economy is actually at the service of individual acting persons. This is perhaps one of the most foundational things behind Ludwig von Mises' economics, right? People express their values based on where they put their money and their time and their effort into the economy. And then other people in the economy respond to that value system in terms of where you're putting your resources. And the economy shapes itself around the values of the people who are interacting within the marketplace. We don't have to slave away all day because the market machine, it's like in some dystopian novel, right? It's this centralized machine demands more productivity. That's not what we advocate for. That's not a good model of free market economics. Well, with that, we better wrap up. We're over 50 minutes. There are actually plenty of little rants I could have gone on but let's call it a day for now. Thank you for your article on this. The Purpose of Production and the Economy, A Criticism of Pronatalist Economics is the name of the article. Check it out at Mises.org. That's Mises.org. If you're interested in this stuff, make sure and look at the top and click on subscribe, or you can even click where it says support Mises and give some money to the Mises Institute if you are so inclined. So thank you everyone for listening in. Thank you, Ryan, for joining me today. Everyone out there, we'll see you next time.